Hello, Dreamers, and welcome to this week's episode. Before we get started, I have a few notes about the show. This is an independent one-woman production, which means I depend on listeners to help give the show more visibility. And there are a number of ways that you can help. You can leave a nice rating and a review on whichever platforms you listen to your podcast on. You can recommend the show in true crime discussion groups and in online forums. You can follow the show on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And if you're looking for more content to listen to and you have a dollar or two to spare each month, you can subscribe to Patreon. And if a subscription isn't your thing, but you would still like to contribute, you may do so through PayPal using my email, californiapod@gmail.com. And it has been a minute since I've thanked patrons, so this week I would like to take the time to thank Sashi, Lindsay G., Diane S., Carly Eileen, Diane C., Lindsay L., Nikki C., Anne B., Chris P., Mo. There were two Lindsays and there are two Alexandrias this week as well, Alexandria P. and Alexandria C., Melanie B., Sherry N., and Lauren C. I'm thanking you all for joining Patreon, raising your pledge, coming back, or contributing through PayPal. And before we get started with this episode, I have to provide you with a warning. This particular episode contains details involving extreme violence, sexual assault, child sexual abuse, and some instances of torture. Listener discretion is advised. July 22nd, 2007 started off like any other normal Sunday afternoon. 11-year-old Michaela Pettit really wanted to prepare dinner for her family, which consisted of herself, her older sister, Haley, and her parents, William and Jennifer. So that evening, Jennifer, who was 48 years old at the time, took her daughter, Michaela, to the local grocery store so that they could get the items that they needed for dinner. Neither Jennifer nor Michaela could have had any idea that while they were in that store looking for groceries, someone else was in that store looking at them. His name was Joshua Karmasajewski. We'll just call him Joshua. He found himself quite interested in Michaela. Yeah, 11 years old, so already you know that we're talking about some serious low-life scumbags here. Joshua decided that he was going to follow Jennifer and Michaela. Not just around the store or out into the parking lot. No, his plan was to follow them all the way to their home in the town of Cheshire in the state of Connecticut. As Joshua left the store to follow mom and daughter home, he received a text message from his partner, for lack of a better word. At the time, his name was Stephen Hayes. But in the years since this incident took place, Stephen Hayes has since transitioned and now identifies as a transgender woman named Linda. So to keep it simple and to not confuse things, we will refer to him by his last name, Hayes. And I'm also going to refer to him by his male pronouns because that's what he was identifying as at the time that this incident took place. So the text message from Hayes read, "I'm chomping at the bit to get started. Need a margarita soon." Hayes texted again, "We still on?" And Joshua replied, "Yes." Hayes texted back, "Soon?" Joshua replied, "I'm putting the kid to bed. Hold your horses." Hayes answered, "Dude, the horses want to get loose, LOL." From there, these two men put a plan in motion to carry out a series of crimes at the home of the Pettit family. When Joshua spotted Michaela and Jennifer in the store, he saw two things that he wanted, Michaela and money. The plan was for Hayes and Joshua to go to the Pettit home after it got dark in the early morning hours, late into the night, and rob them. It's been said that they planned on tying the family up while they gathered up the things that they wanted and to leave them bound and gagged, but otherwise there was no plan to harm anyone. Hayes and Joshua showed up at the Pettit house in the early hours of July 23rd. This is now Monday morning. Joshua entered the home through an unlocked basement door. Leaning on the stairway that led down into the basement was a baseball bat. What the two men didn't expect was to find William Pettit asleep on a couch in an adjacent sunroom on the main level of the house. Finding William asleep in the downstairs area caused Hayes and Joshua to quickly come up with a new plan. But this plan wasn't meant to be like the first one, where they just tie everybody up, rob everyone, and leave. No, this was not going to go down the way that Hayes and Joshua claimed that they said they hoped it would. Later on that morning, still Monday, July 23rd, 2007, at 9:21 a.m., a call came in to the Cheshire 911 dispatch. The caller said, "My name is Mary Lyons. I'm the banking center manager. We have a lady who is in our bank right now who says that her husband and children are being held at their house. The people are in a car outside the bank. She's getting $15,000 to bring out to them, and if the police are told, they'll kill the children and the husband. Her name is Jennifer Pettit, P-E-T-I-T. The dispatcher asked if Jennifer Pettit was still in the bank, and the caller confirmed that she was. I have a picture of Jennifer standing at the teller counter, taken by a surveillance camera, and the worry on her face is very obvious. The dispatcher confirmed that the husband and children were being held hostage at their house and that they are tied up and that the perpetrators drove Jennifer to the bank. The bank manager tried to look to see what was going on with Jennifer at that moment in real time. She told the dispatcher that she was walking out of the bank and that she looked petrified. Approximately 1 hour later, the area surrounding the Pettit home looked like a war zone. The whole block was cordoned off. The Pettit house had been set on fire. Crumpled up police squad cars and debris littered the streets, and the area was crawling with police and fire officials and the media. All police were saying at the onset of this event is that they can confirm that three people had been killed inside the Pettit home, and that they knew for sure that two of them were female, and that they are waiting to hear more information about the third person. The person answering the media questions did say that the survivor inside the home was male. So, knowing what we know about the Pettit family, we see that the only person to live through this ordeal on that day was Dr. William Pettit. Though he was very severely injured, he did survive. But sadly, his wife, Jennifer, their 17-year-old daughter, Haley, who had just graduated from high school a couple of months earlier, and their 11-year-old daughter, Michaela, all three of them perished in the fire. A fire that was set by the home invaders. And yes, the girls were alive when the fire was set. They were doused in an accelerant, but ultimately succumbed to smoke inhalation. Their mom died of asphyxiation due to manual strangulation. She was deceased before the fire was started. Let's take some time and talk a little bit about who the Pettits were. Jennifer Pettit was a registered nurse and the director of the health center at Cheshire Academy, which is a private boarding school. She and William Pettit met in 1985 at the Children's Hospital of Pittsburgh. She was an oncology nurse and he was a third-year medical student. They got married that same year. Haley Pettit, as I said, had just graduated from high school and was set to start attending Dartmouth College, where she intended to follow in the footsteps of her parents and study medicine. In school, Haley was also an honor student who was on the cross-country and basketball teams. She was very active in community service, and she actively fundraised for multiple sclerosis research. After Jennifer was diagnosed, she led an MS walk called Haley's Hope. Haley felt like she needed to take action and do something because she was afraid that if she didn't, she would lose her mom to the disease. At the time of her death, Haley had managed to raise more than $50,000 for MS research. 11-year-old Michaela attended Chase Collegiate School, and her plan for the upcoming fall semester when her sister left for Dartmouth was to take over Haley's Hope MS Walk and rename it Michaela's Miracle. Michaela had a passion for cooking, which is why her mom had taken her to that local grocery store the night before their murders. Michaela was the one who had the dinner plans that night. The only survivor was Dr. William Pettit, who was an endocrinologist at the time of the home invasion. He was also the medical director at Joslyn Diabetes Center at Central Hospital. Dr. Pettit was dedicated to his family and to his work. Despite being severely injured in the home invasion attack, he managed to escape through an exit in the basement that led to the outside. After this incident, Dr. Pettit did not go back to practicing medicine. Later on that afternoon, a representative with the Connecticut State Police held a press conference. In part, he stated, "Upon arrival at the victim's residence, the first officer observed two male subjects exit the private residence and also observed the private residence fully engulfed in flames. The suspect vehicle rammed the Cheshire police officer's car and then continued on Sorghum Mill Road." Well, both Joshua and Hayes were caught within moments of the crash. They were driving the Pettit's vehicle, trying to escape. At the time that this happened, Joshua Komarczewski was 26 years old and Linda, formerly Stephen Hayes, was 44 years old. It was about 3 in the morning when Joshua and Hayes arrived at the Pettit home, but they happened to find Dr. Pettit asleep on a couch downstairs in the sunroom. So Joshua entered the home through an unlocked basement door. When he entered the basement, he found a baseball bat that was leaning against the stairs that led to the upstairs level. Joshua grabbed that bat and went into the sunroom and proceeded to strike Dr. Pettit about the head approximately 4 or 5 times, splitting his head open in multiple places. From there, both Hayes and Joshua bound Dr. Pettit with zip ties and rope. Dr. Pettit overheard one of the perpetrators tell the other one, "If he moves, put 2 bullets in him." Michaela, Haley, and Jennifer were subsequently bound in each of their bedrooms. All of them were tied up. Michaela and Haley were tied to their beds by their wrists and their ankles, and pillowcases were put over their heads. William was brought down to the basement, where he was kept seated on the sofa, bound by the hands and ankles. From there, Joshua and Hayes searched the house for cash and valuables, but they weren't finding what they were hoping to find. There was no cash in the house. However, they did find a checking account register that showed a balance of $40,000. The two of them decided to wait until the bank opened at 9 a.m., and they would have Jennifer Pettit go into the branch in person and withdraw money directly. Jennifer's sister, Cynthia, who lived down in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, her phone rang that Monday afternoon. When she answered it, she found it was Dr. Pettit's sister on the other end, and she immediately knew that something was wrong and felt that it had to do with one of the girls, either Michaela or Haley. From there, Dr. Pettit's sister proceeded to tell her how they beat up Dr. Pettit with a baseball bat and that his forehead was split wide open. Then she said that the men terrorized the girls and Jennifer during the night while they waited for the bank to open. When the morning came, Hayes went to a gas station. He brought with him 2 gas cans that were taken from the Pettit home and filled them up with about $10 worth of gas. When he got back, he and Jennifer drove down to the bank. Jennifer withdrew on a $15,000 line of credit. Then she left to go back home, but not before telling the bank teller that there were 2 men holding her children and her husband hostage at their home and that they were threatening to kill them unless she brought them this money. That is when the bank manager called 911 to report what was happening to the Cheshire police. She was reporting the situation as it was unfolding in real time, up to the point where Jennifer left the bank branch to go back home. The bank manager did say that Jennifer told her that the perpetrators were being nice and that she believed that all they wanted was the money. Unfortunately, that wasn't true. The Cheshire police responded by making their way over to the Pettit's neighborhood, setting up a perimeter, but they did so without letting their presence around the home be known. This, along with the police department's overall response, will be criticized for years to come. And to this day, the Cheshire Police have never said a word about it except to defend their actions about 3 years after the fact in 2010. We will come to find out that the police were nearby, just outside, hiding in trees, hiding in bushes, and all the while, the killings were going on inside in real time. Yes, the police were right outside, discussing whether or not the Pettits were actually in danger and deciding to not bring in a hostage negotiator. There was never a phone call that was made to the hostage takers. And that's the move, one of the moves that would be heavily criticized in the aftermath of all this. When Jennifer was being raped and strangled by Joshua, while 11-year-old Michaela was being sexually assaulted by Hayes, and while Haley was terrified and bound to her bed. Yep, the police were right outside when the perpetrators decided it was time to leave. In fact, some of the police officers and first responders heard screams come from inside the home when they got there. So it was Jennifer's sister Cynthia who had to break the news to their parents that not only did they lose one of only two children that they had, they lost both of their granddaughters, two out of four grandkids that they had as well. She told them that the only one to barely escape with his life was Dr. Pettit. They called him Billy, but out of respect, I'm going to call him Dr. Pettit. They rushed to the hospital to see him, and he was beaten so badly about the head. He had a whole mess of stitches that kind of looked like the scar that Frankenstein's monster has on his forehead. And the first thing that Dr. Pettit did was tell his in-laws that he was sorry he wasn't able to save their daughter and their granddaughters. But they could see that Dr. Pettit was in horrible shape. He's lucky to have escaped with his life. They had to convince him that there was nothing to apologize for, and that they would forever be grateful that he managed to escape with his own life. The murders of Jennifer Haley and Michaela Pettit made national headlines, and many of us, myself included, remember this very well in the summer of 2007. The details of what Joshua Karmaczewski and Stephen Hayes did started trickling into the media, and people were not just in disbelief as to the depravity of what they did. It was just how it all unfolded. It was unbelievable how things happened. Because the thing is, these two were taken into custody as they tried to get away. Remember, the police were waiting for them outside. They did not make their presence known. So when Hayes and Joshua were fixing to flee the scene, they stepped right into a police perimeter that completely surrounded the Pettit home and nearby streets. And they both immediately provided confessions afterwards. There is an audio recording of Joshua's confession, but the sound quality is terrible, and I absolutely cannot understand most of what he's saying. Fortunately, there's a transcript, and I'm going to read it to you instead of playing the audio recording, because you won't hear half the crap this guy has to say, and it's terrible. So Joshua provided his confession a little more than maybe about 12 hours after he and Hayes entered the Pettit home and this whole nightmare began. It was July 23rd, 2007, at 4:55 p.m. at the Cheshire Police Department. Present was Detective Joseph Vitello and Detective Rafael Medina of the Central District Major Crime Squad with the Connecticut State Police, and Joshua Karmaczewski. He provided his date of birth, which was August 10th, 1980. At the time, he was 27. I might have said he was 26 earlier. He's about to be 28, I guess. No, he's about to turn 27. He also provided his address, phone numbers, and he acknowledged that he knew that he was at the Cheshire Police Department. Detective Vitello asked him, "Do you know why you are here?" And Joshua answered, he says a lot of ums and a lot of awkward pauses and the way that he says things. So I'm going to leave them all out because it gets really annoying. And I think it adds about 30 minutes to this whole interrogation. But anyway, he answered, "For a home invading gone terribly wrong. Okay, Joshua, How many years of education do you have? Some college. Did you get your high school diploma? Yes. And you have some college? Yes. Okay, so you understand and can read and write English? Yes. Okay, so now Joshua, when we were with you a little while ago and we started talking to you, we read you a notice and waiver of rights, which are your constitutional rights. That's correct. Now, did you do that freely of your own will and willpower? Yes. Okay, do you have any questions about that? No. Okay, that form is in front of us and it has been signed by you, Detective Medina, and myself. That's correct. Okay, and we did discuss this incident and you started to give us a written statement. You got about made through one page, and at that point we discussed if you would like to give us a taped audio tape statement, and you agreed to that, correct? That's correct. And that is a decision that you are comfortable with? That's correct. Okay, now in your written statement, we had you stop and we had you write that you wanted to go from the written form to the taped form, correct? That's correct. Okay, now the written form is in front of us. You have ended that statement and signed it. Now we're going to begin the taped statement. We're going to go over the entire incident from the start. Let's go back to the beginning where this is your statement. You stated that you met up with this other fellow. Yeah, Stephen Hayes. Okay, and then we discussed yesterday, you started around afternoon time. I guess you started telling us what transpired. You went to the Stop and Shop in Cheshire. That's correct. To meet a contractor. To meet up with, to receive payment from a contractor that I did work for on that day. Let's go through and go over the whole statement that you were going to put in writing. At what time? Towards 6 o'clock-ish or so in the evening? Yeah, in the evening. I was waiting for a contractor to make payment, and while I was waiting, I saw a mother and a daughter walk into a store, into the Stop and Shop, and I thought they were driving a very nice vehicle. And I really didn't think much of it at the time because the contractor had shown up and we were discussing business and making payment. At which point, about 15 minutes later, the mother came back out with the daughter and got in their car. As the contractor was driving off, we had completed our transaction. For whatever reason, I chose to follow the mom and the daughter to the house. And I started thinking, that is a very nice house and a very nice car. And I thought it would be nice to be there someday, not to have to worry about financial problems and stress and all that, everything that comes with it. Throughout the day, Mr. Hayes had been calling me, wanting to hook up and discuss options on how we could come up with some money fast, whether it be legally or illegally obtained. That evening, I had spent the rest of the evening with my daughter. She had just recently come back from a one-week vacation with her grandparents, and I hadn't seen her in a little over a week. So I stayed home and spent some time with her, and I put her to bed. And about 10 o'clock rolled around, I made a decision to go out and meet up with Mr. Hayes at the Stop and Shop Plaza. From there, we started. He asked where we were going, and we drove around for a while, trying to come up with ideas for like what we could do to make money and to make money quick. Did he drive in a vehicle or did somebody drop him off? No, he drove in his boss's truck. Okay, so when you were at the Stop and Shop parking lot, we were both at the Stop and Shop parking lot. He got into your vehicle? Yeah, he got into mine. Okay, go ahead. So from there, we went on driving around, talking about ways to score money with different contracts. We tried making new material. Nothing seemed to be fast enough. We had many debts and obligations. The conversation then turned to the possibility of maybe illegally obtaining cash quickly. One of which of the ideas was to maybe to come up on, you know, people taking money out of ATMs and catching them by surprise, or possibly someone coming out of a bar late at night. Neither one of those ideas panned out, and we just sort of aimlessly drove around instead. At which time I had recalled that I had seen this lady driving a very nice car and knew where a very nice house was, and had made mention of that to Mr. Hayes and the possibility of a lot of money being in the house might be fairly decent. So we made it over to that house and parked on their street, but around the corner a little ways, out of sight. We donned face masks and put on rubber gloves and walked down the sidewalk to the house. Can you describe those face masks to us? What they might have looked like? Well, consider we really did this on the fly and there was no planning involved or anything. So I used my dark shirt and cut some holes in it and just tied it around my face. And Mr. Hayes used a work hat that he had just pulled over his face and cut two holes for the eyes and the nose and a little below his chin. Were you carrying any weapons at this point? Did you have anything illegal on you? I did not carry a weapon at that point. Mr. Hayes had a pellet, a handgun, pellet gun, or a BB gun that he had purchased at Walmart in Southington. What day did you purchase it? I'm not sure what day he purchased it. The day prior, I believe it was, to this incident. Were you with him when he purchased it? I was in the store with him, yes. At the Walmart in Southington. Yes, Walmart in Southington. Did you pay cash? He went to the teller and he paid cash, yes. Okay, now you approach the house. No other weapons. No weapons, no. We approached the house and went around back to see who was, if there were any lights on or if anyone was awake. At that time, we noticed the father was sleeping downstairs in the sunroom. Which is where? On the front of the house? On the side? It's on the back of the house. We continued to do a walk around the house and check the windows and doors, all of which were locked. Till we came to the bilcony door at the rear of the house and went down into the basement, which was unlocked. I opened it and proceeded down the steps and found that the door in the basement itself was also unlocked. What time do you think this was about? This was about 2:15 by that time I had made access into the house. In the morning? Yes, in the morning. So now you're inside of the residence. Actually, it may have been a little later. It might be closer to like 2:30, 2:45. I had mentioned that I didn't think I would be able to take on the father alone, and Steve had mentioned that he didn't think he could creep into the house quietly enough to get up close to him. And I mentioned that maybe I should find a bat or an object of similar weight to club him with and to incapacitate him temporarily so that we could tie him up. So I went and proceeded down into the basement and happened to find a baseball bat leaning on the stairs leading up to the kitchen. I took that bat and I went up the stairway, sort of made my way through the dinette area to the doors leading into the sunroom where the father was sleeping. At which point, I just stood there for a good 15-20 minutes. I was standing behind him with this bat and not wanting to hit him, not thinking that I could. I could see Mr. Hayes in the window motioning to strike him and to get it over with and to get it done so we can move on. Did you strike him? I did. Okay, you got up close? Where and how many times did you strike this man? I hit him in the head with a baseball bat. He let out this unearthly scream. I couldn't take his screaming, like I had never hit anybody in the head with anything, never mind a baseball bat. And I just kept telling him until he finally backed up into the corner of the couch and quieted down and was just staring at me with wide open eyes, just sheer confusion. Was he bleeding? Yeah, he was bleeding profusely. Okay, so now he's on the couch, curled up. Then what happens? Mr. Hayes is now tapping on the door window to my right, motioning for me to unlock the door for him. I gathered myself and unlocked the door and he came in. We argued for a minute as to who was going to tie him up, at which point we both ended up tying him up. Mr. Hayes tied his hands, I tied his feet. We sat him on the couch. And what did you use to tie him with? I had seen a cotton rope similar to one you would use for a clothesline, sitting at the top of the stairs leading into the kitchen, and retrieved that, cut it into 2-foot lengths, roughly, to bind hands and feet with. I tied his hands and feet, or I tied his feet and Mr. Hayes tied his hands, and we sat him on the furniture. When I say furniture, the couch. And he asked us quietly who we were, what our intentions were, and who we wanted. I replied that we were simply there for money. Once we have everything we came there for, then we would be out of there and we would be gone. I asked if there was anybody else in the house now and how many, The homeowner mentioned that there were three women upstairs, at which point Mr. Hayes and I proceeded up the stairway. He had the BB gun, and I had the bat with me, and both of us had rope, many different pieces of rope. We passed the first daughter's room on the left-hand side and went down the hallway to the master bedroom, where we would just do the mother first and then the two children, only to find that one of the youngest daughters had actually fallen asleep with the mom watching TV in the master bedroom. Mr. Hayes and I walked into the room, and I to the daughter's side of the bed, and Mr. Hayes to the mother's side of the bed, at which point Mr. Hayes put his hand over mom's mouth and shook her gently awake. And I did. I followed suit with the youngest daughter. They both had woken up. They were very confused as to what was going on, but very compliant when told to roll over on their stomachs and put their hands behind their backs. We tied their hands and feet. When we left the room and proceeded back towards the daughter's room that we passed and walked in, Mr. Hayes stood over her, the oldest daughter. I went to the headboard and shook her gently awake. She was a little more than a little surprised by what was going on. She asked what we wanted and please don't hurt her, at which point I explained to her that we weren't there to hurt her. When she didn't say anything else, I asked her to roll over onto her stomach and put her hands behind her back. She did, so I tied her hands and then her feet. Mr. Hayes tied her hands, after which Mr. Hayes and I proceeded to empty the house of valuables. Now we are both in the mother's room, and she's telling Mr. Hayes where different locations were of her jewelry and whatnot, things that I wasn't interested in. It was my understanding that Mr. Hayes and I were there strictly for cash, and I was getting a little frustrated with him planning to do other than that. You were looking strictly for cash? Just cash. Where is the father at this time? The father was still downstairs in the sunroom on the couch. We'd periodically go downstairs to check on him. At one point, on one of my trips down there, he was still bleeding profusely, so I found a towel in the kitchen and put it on his head so it would stop the bleeding. When you tied up the daughters, did you tie them to anything? No, not at first. They were tied up. They weren't restrained to the bed or anything like that. You mean that their hands and feet were tied, but they weren't tied to anything at the time? That's right. So Stephen and I continued poking around for money and realizing that there was no money there. The mother had mentioned that there was no safe, and Steve had found a check register with the amount of $40,000+ in it. We discussed the possibility of sending the mother down to the bank to retrieve a sum of $15,000. We didn't want to withdraw the full amount of $40,000 in fear of raising some kind of red flag at the bank. The mother agreed. We reassured her that if she complied, that, you know, there wouldn't be any problems. You know, we were there simply here for the money and we would be on our way. What time do you think it was now? Getting around 3:30, 4 o'clock, or around that time? Okay, so aside from them being tied up and the father being injured, no one else at this point was injured. That's correct. Okay, go ahead. Mr. Hayes has continued to rifle through the bedroom for some time to come. He was getting on my nerves with the amount of noise that he was making. I had locked eyes with the youngest daughter. I was kind of taken aback by how calm she was being. She had this look on her face that she understood, like, you know that, yeah, we're here, and we were invading her home, and that she understood. Like, she seemed to have this look on her, you know, that she understood that we wouldn't hurt them, you know? We'd just be on our way. That sort of caught me off guard. We kept going back and forth between downstairs, you know, checking on the dad, and then I realized it was starting to get a little light outside and realized that we were going to have to make a decision on what we were going to do with my car because it was still parked out on the street around the corner. And I knew that I couldn't leave it there. Stephen and I got into an argument about how we were going, where and how we were going to move it and where we're going to bring it. Why hadn't you left the house at this point? To where? To park the vehicle? No, why didn't you just leave the house then? the money. Okay, so you had no intent on leaving the house at that point. You were just concerned about the car and where you were going to park it. Yeah, because we had sort of set upon having the mom go to the bank and withdraw the money once the banks open at 9 o'clock. The mother seemed compliant about it. Okay, so you were going to wait it out until it was time to do that? Yeah, we were going to sit it out. So we were making arrangements to move the car, but nobody in the house was restrained to anything. Steve was worried about that, you know. Once we left to move the vehicle somewhere, they could just scatter and we would come back to a house full of cops. So they were tied, not restrained. That's correct. So at which point, we went back upstairs, Steve and I, and we went into the mom's bedroom where the youngest daughter and the mom were. I untied the feet of the youngest daughter and moved her into her own room. I tied her to the rope that I was tying her hands and looped it under, untied one of her hands and looped it underneath the bed frame, and then reattached the other end of the rope to her other wrist. In her own bedroom? In her own bedroom, yeah. In her own bed. And then I did the same with her ankles. Tied one ankle and then looped the rope through the bed frame and then tied the other ankle with the other end. So it was not too tight because I noticed that she had eczema and I suffer from that myself. What the fuck, right? What a sick fuck. He noticed that she had eczema. Get the fuck out of here. Anyway, this piece of shit continued. I walked out of the daughter's bedroom and Mr. Hayes had tied the mother to the master bed on her stomach, sprawled out. I thought it was a little uncomfortable for mom, but time was sort of the essence. And I went down the hall and entered the other daughter's bedroom and untied her restraints and reattached them to the bed in a similar fashion that I had did for the youngest daughter, untying one wrist and looping it. The only problem with hers is where her top headboard was, she didn't have a crossbar, so we had to tie her wrists together and then loop it onto the bedpost, and then her legs, headboard, we looped around the lower bedpost. So she was tied differently than the younger daughter? Yes, she was laying in the same position, just modified, a different knot. We went downstairs and asked the father for the keys to his vehicle. We couldn't find them because stuff was scattered all over the place. So Stephen went back upstairs and asked the mother where her keys were. He found them and came back downstairs and went out into the sunroom, back door, got into mom's vehicle, and I went down into the basement, out the basement Bilco hatch door, and walked into the opposite direction where my van was parked. Your van is a what? A white Chevy Venture. And that was parked down the street. Yeah, it was parked out on the street around the corner. Okay. Did you do anything with the telephones before you left? Steve and I had taken all the cell phones and all the portable phones and put them in a central location so we could keep track of where the phones were. You had taken the family's phones then? Yeah, the family phones. Okay, and you did that for what purpose? So nobody can make any phone calls, you know, without us knowing about it. Okay, now everyone in the house is restrained at this point. Or, to clarify that for us, you have the mom and the younger daughter tied and restrained to their beds. That's correct. What about the other daughter? Well, the other daughter was also restrained to her bed. To her own bed? In her own bedroom. And the father is still downstairs in the sunroom sitting on the couch. He's tied but not restrained to the couch. So, for whatever reason, you didn't restrain him? We didn't restrain him. So we left. Stephen in mom's car and me in my car. And we drove down Mountain Road. Did you leave the father in the sunroom? Yes. Okay, so you're driving and you go get your car. And Steve takes mom's four-wheel drive. It's a sport utility, but much sportier, like an SUV, but a cross between a car and an SUV. Do you remember the color? Not off the top of my head. Okay, so Steve drives, you drive. Where do you go? We drove down Mountain Road. The original plan was to park my van at the Stop and Shop, but Steve felt it was too far away. I noticed that I passed Steve on Mountain Road, and I pulled into a condo complex across the street from West Main Street at the end of Mountain. Any particular reason you picked that? No. I just figured that I could park in one of the visitor parking spots and wouldn't be noticed. We'd be hiding in plain sight. I got out of my vehicle. I locked it. Steve turned around and came back, and I got into Mom's car with Steve, and we drove back to the house. We had gotten into an argument on the way back to the house about his speed, because I knew that the Cheshire Police Department patrolled Mountain Road for speeders on the regular. So you didn't want to get stopped. Yeah, we didn't want to get stopped on the way back to the house in a vehicle that wasn't ours. Okay, so now you're back at the house. You come in the homeowner's vehicle. Yes, you go back to the house. We enter into the house from the sunroom back door. The father was still sitting on the couch. He asked us if the women were all right, and I responded by saying, reassuring him that they were fine, that they were behaving themselves, and that everything would be fine. So Steve was jumping around the house, looking through stuff and whatnot. I went upstairs. I stopped at the youngest daughter. I noticed that she was, since being separated from her mom earlier, was a lot more stressed out than she was earlier. She was sweating profusely on her bed. I went back downstairs and got her a glass of water, brought that back up to her. I untied her hands and asked if she wanted something to drink. The sleeping bag that she used as a bedspread and the top sheet, I took off and threw it off the side because they were soaking wet. And when she was done with a glass of water, I let her lay back down without tying her hands so that she was a little more comfortable. I felt comfortable not tying her up, as she was very well behaved, very compliant. How about the fact that she's 11 and terrified, and you're a grown-ass man causing her all of this terror? She's a child, and he's just a fucking coward. The detective asked, did you do anything to her during your time together? No, we just talked about things. And dreamers, it goes without saying that this is not true. We just talked about things, about her music and like whatnot. And we periodically, you know, we checked on the older sister and the mother and the father. So things are pretty status quo at this point in the house. You guys are still buying time? Yeah, we were buying time. Steve and I were nipping at each other a little bit because of the stress level was very high, and I never done anything like this before. Anyway, I was very uncomfortable with the situation, and I just felt very out of control with the whole thing. And then something happens. The stress was starting to build between Steve and I. Okay, so where are we time-wise? What time do you think we're at? This is probably about 5 o'clock-ish, 5:30-ish in the morning. And there was definitely light outside. It was starting to get light out. At that point, we realized that we had to get the father out of the sunroom because it was getting so light, and the potential of the high visibility that would, we didn't want anybody to see him tied up with a towel on his head. Now, you were afraid that someone could see him through the house, that he was hurt or whatever? Yeah, so we untied his feet and asked him if he was able to walk down to the basement. He said that he was, and I helped him, you know, get up, and he was a little dizzy. But he walked over to the basement stairs and made his way down the steps and down into the basement. We were going to have him lean up, sit down in the middle area of the basement, and lean up against one of the lolly columns, which is a support column that provides structural support in a building. But he was a little shaky from probably the issues of shock and losing blood. You think? This guy's a genius, right? He wasn't bleeding as bad as when we started the towel. So I went upstairs and grabbed him the big cushion off the couch and slid his head on that instead of the cold concrete floor, and I got another pillow for his back against the lolly column. Did you tie him back up? Yeah, we tied his feet, and Steve stood over the two of us with the fake gun. Was he assaulted again? He was not, no. He was not assaulted again. He was just that one time. Just the one time? Okay. So he's back downstairs. He's restrained. Is he tied to the lolly column? No, he wasn't tied to the lolly column. He was just sitting there. So we went back upstairs and Steve was just rummaging around. And he did some cleanup in the sunroom. Steve did. The table was knocked over and there was some blood on the tile floor. So we threw a blanket over it. We threw like a throw spread over the couch, over the back of the couch, so somebody looking wouldn't notice because there was blood all over the place. I went back upstairs to check on the two daughters. Detective Vitello then said, "So you came downstairs with Dad, with Steve. You retied him. You moved him because you were worried about daylight. So then you came up. You took care of some blood in the sunroom. You went back upstairs, you said. You went back upstairs to check on the other females that were restrained. They're still restrained in the same spot that they were before you went and moved the cars and whatnot? Yeah, we still had them in their beds." We had also, or Steve had brought up the point that what they did for work and whether or not they needed to be, if someone needed to call in sick for them. So Steve went down to the basement and asked the father when he needed, what time he needed to be into work, and who needed to be called to inform them that he was going to be late. I went to the mother and asked what time she needed to be in at work, and she advised me that she was a teacher and she was off for the summer, so it was a non-issue. The father, on the other hand, is a doctor apparently, and he didn't have to be into the office until 8:30, but he needed to make rounds at the hospital around 7, so he was expected to be somewhere at 7. He made mention that, of a supervisor's name that he had to contact to say that he wasn't feeling well and that he would not be in on time for work. Okay, was that call made? No, that call wasn't made. Steve and I went upstairs and untied the mother from her bed and we had her come. On the way downstairs, she asked us if she could peek into both of her children's rooms to make sure that both daughters were fine. And I was fine with that, and it sort of helped to reassure KK as well. Who's KK? KK is the youngest daughter, the one that I was spending time talking to. So yeah, dreamers, this scumbag is calling the 11-year-old by her nickname. And it disgusts me to no end. But anyway. We head downstairs with the mom and we have her sit on the love seat in the living room where I retied her feet and then her hands. And Steve went to scrounge up the other phone, the house phone, which was in the kitchen. He got back. He came back over and gave her the phone, but she couldn't dial it. So I untied her hands again and she made the call. I had then gone in. I posted up in the kitchen just, you know, looking around, looking out the windows, just, you know, overseeing different entry points in the house while Steve went to the door to make the necessary phone calls to call the father out. When that was done, Steve had called me over to tie her hands back up. He put the phone back in the kitchen and he thanked her that she did a good job for doing that. At that point, Steve was feeling a lot more comfortable with the mother going into the bank and withdrawing the $15,000 that we had originally come to. Okay, and what bank were you planning on doing this at? The original plan was that we were going to go to the Bank of America in Waterbury. That was my understanding. I felt it would be better that we had a bank that's not familiar with her and would notice that she was in distress. Okay. At this point now, you check and you allow the mom to check on the bedrooms and those children. The two female daughters were tied but not harmed? No. Fully clothed? Yeah, they were. No issues. No. No issues at all. Okay, go on. At this point, several hours to kill now. It's only about 6:30, 6:45 at that point. It's daylight? Yeah, it's definitely daylight outside. I was getting annoyed with Steve again because there weren't that many shades downstairs and he was constantly walking back and forth across the windows. I got to the point where I was getting so frustrated that I just went back upstairs again to check on the daughters and struck up a conversation with KK. Got her some more water. She needed to go to the bathroom, so I untied her and allowed her to use the bathroom in the master bedroom. When she was done, she came back into her room where I restrained her feet, but you know, I let her hands be where they were previously. I also went to give some water to the oldest daughter, but she really wasn't that thirsty, which was fine, you know. We were starting to get down to crunch time. Crunch time, meaning what? We were thinking of Steve leaving with the mom at about 8:45. The bank opened at 9, so about 8:45 would be a good time to leave. The bank was in Waterbury, and it takes about 20 minutes to get there. Okay, so how it looks still where we are, okay? As far as no one's injured other than the father? Yeah. You were buying time until 9 o'clock when you think you should go to the bank? Yeah. There were the times that I was sitting in the bedroom with KK, and Steve had come in and motioned for me to follow him into the office, where the occupants of the house could not overhear us talking, and said that we needed gasoline. And I was surprised because gasoline was never even a factor in what was going on here. We were just supposed to get the money and get out, and he was going on and on about DNA, and even from a drop of sweat or a hair falling off your head is going to be enough to put us in jail because they have our DNA on record. He had first mentioned that we could take the occupants of the home with us in their vehicles and leave the house burning in their wake. I'm a little stunned and perplexed about the whole situation, and he went back downstairs and I went back into KK's room. About 15 minutes later, Steve came back and he motioned me to go back into the office with him, and he began ranting and raving about DNA and how he was mad at me because I had on several occasions used his name in front of the occupants of the house. And I, all of a sudden, you know, we gotta kill them. We gotta what? We gotta kill them. Kill them? Yeah, kill the family. And then burn the house down on top of them. That was not in the plan. That was not the plan. I'm not killing anyone, you know, that's it. That is not how this is going down. Like, we were here simply for the money. Get in and get out, you know? It's almost 9 o'clock, and why? Why are you bugging now? Plus, then I had gotten on his case. If he was so worried about DNA, why was he walking around without his gloves on now? He removed his gloves? Yeah. He removed his gloves, and I was like, you know, what are you doing? Why did he remove them? I don't know. I'm not sure. At this point, he no longer has gloves on? He no longer has gloves on. And you still did. I had gloves on the entire time. Are your masks still on your head? Sometimes we'd pull it up so we could pull it down at a moment's notice, but we had put pillowcases over the occupants' heads. You did? Yeah, so they couldn't see us. When did you do that? We had done that after we had split them up. They came back from the car ride because it was getting a little... Vision was difficult, more difficult to be walking around the house with these very awkward face shields on that we had come up with on the fly. So you covered their faces because you wanted to uncover your face? Yes, correct. Okay, you were trying to suffocate them at that time? No, not at all. You were just trying to prevent them from seeing you. Exactly. But at this point, other than you slipping with using Steve's real name, they really couldn't identify you facially because you were pretty much concealed. Yeah, I was very confident that they wouldn't be able to, you know, recognize us. As far as the suffocation part, the suffocation thing with the pillowcases, like when we put it over, like I made it a point to roll it up, to roll it back like over their head, but then to roll it back up. Did you just cover their eyes? No, so it would just cover their eyes, not their nose and mouth. It does get hot, especially, you know, underneath the pillowcases. Sure, I'm sure. Especially when you're stressed. Absolutely. I lost my train of thought. You were up to almost 9 o'clock when he starts to bug out on you. He's starting to feel the pressure about leaving the house with the mom and then having to lose sight of the mom when she went into the bank. And he's sitting in the parking lot and things are a little tense between the two of us. Uncomfortable at times. All right, now how did the conversation about killing the family end? Like, he just walked away, like a statement. It wasn't a conversation. It was a statement, and that's how it was going to be, you know? And that's that. In my mind, that's simply not an option. It's just not an option. Did you mention that to him? I had made mention that, you know, I'm not killing anybody, you know? I'm not going to. He didn't seem to care or whatever. He was just focused on going to his truck in the next 10 to 15 minutes. So dreamers, here we have Joshua putting the blame for the murders on Stephen Hayes. Well, I mean, the guy is confessing to lots of stuff, but he's also minimizing other things as well at the same time. He continued, just to back up a little bit, when he had first mentioned something about burning the house down, he had gone down to the garage and taken a bunch of 1-gallon bottles of windshield wiper fluid, and drained those into the sink. I heard the chugging of something being drained into the sink, and I went downstairs to see what it was this time, and he said, you know, I'm going to get gas. I'll be in Mom's car. I'll be back. So he, at this point, he drains the bottles and he's going to get gas, which he does in fact do, taking Mom's car and leaving you at home with everyone else, with everybody else, leaves me with everybody and just takes off. Okay, what time do you think this was? The drop was at 9, or the pickup was at 9, so this is probably about 8 o'clock-ish. Okay, 8 o'clock in the morning? Where do you think he went? Well, he didn't say where he was going to go get it. I was just assuming that he was just probably going to go down to the gas station around Mountain because it's right there. But somehow he managed to end up over on Main Street, heading towards Richard Chevrolet and calling me and asking me if there's a gas station up there. And I was like, well, where are you? And he was like, I just passed Richard Chevrolet. And I was like, well, your next gas station isn't until Southington. And Dreamers, at this point, this MFR is starting to laugh. In the audio recording, he's laughing. And because this is such a laughing matter, right? There's so much funny stuff that's going on during this night. That's just hilarious, right? For this guy to be sitting here laughing. It just pisses me off. I don't know how those detectives are just sitting across the table speaking to him so nonchalantly like this, listening to this shit, like they're just shooting the breeze. So Joshua was laughing. He continued and he was like, oh yeah, well, I'll find a closer one. And then he hung up and then he called back, you know, like 15 or 20 minutes later and said, how do I get back from Cheshire to Waterbury? And Joshua laughed some more in the audio recording. So he's calling you saying he's in Waterbury? Yeah. Did he have the gas? He apparently had the gas on his way back. When he had gotten back to the house, he had those 4 containers filled with gas, filled with gasoline, which he put into the garage. Put in the garage, meaning he put them down in the garage or he poured them out? No, he put them down in the garage. Did you help him put this away? No, I was in the kitchen, in the dinette kitchen area. There was no one else down there with you at the time, correct? Everyone else is upstairs in the bedrooms or downstairs in the basement? No, Mom is downstairs. Mom is downstairs? Yeah, she's sitting on the love seat. So Mom has been down there the whole time since she made that call in for her husband to be late for work? Yeah, from that point on, she's been downstairs. Okay, tied but not restrained. Right, tied but not restrained. So, 9. Whatever the hour I made mention before, it was originally 8:45. Mentioned that because he made, you know, a detour in the plan and got back there, and he also wanted to make a bunch of phone calls to the Bank of America. He called 411 to get their number, and using the home phone, wanting to basically ask, you know, somebody at the branch what he needed specifically to withdraw a large sum of money from one's own bank account. He was speaking in generalities, how he was going to. He couldn't get through because it wasn't 9 o'clock yet. So no one is in the bank and they kept referring him to the 800 number, which is an automated system. So he never actually made contact with the bank? No, he was very frustrated about that. So he finally just hung up. Then he got the mom by the hand and then two of them got to the car. Did he untie her? Yes. Completely? Completely, yeah. So her hands and feet are no longer tied. She's untied. She's in the car with him, heading to the Bank of America in Waterbury? That's correct. Who's driving the car? I believe she was driving the car. So they left about 9 o'clock. I went down to check on Dad. He was still sitting downstairs tied. I had gone upstairs and I checked on the older sister. She had needed to go to the bathroom, so I untied her and let her go to the bathroom and retied her in the same position that she was in. I asked her if she wanted water. She said no. Then I went back into KK's room and sat down. We were just talking, you know, just shooting the shit, I guess, just to pass the time. And how old do you think KK is? Somewhere between 14 and 16, possibly. And the other sister you thought was how old? Between 18 and 19. okay, so obviously she told you her nickname or whatever as KK, or you made that up. No, that is the name both her sister and her mother referred to her as. Okay, you're talking to KK just about general things? Yeah, things, school, summer plans, and you know, stuff like that. Boredom sometimes. Obviously not mine. Dreamers, the following details in Joshua Kamerzyzewski's confession involve child sexual abuse. It is graphic in nature and very difficult to listen to. So you can actually just stop listening to this episode now if you would prefer not to hear these graphic details, because this will be it until the end of part one. Joshua Kamerzyzewski's confession continued. One thing led to another, and I ended up having or performing oral sex on her, on KK. You performed oral sex on KK? On KK, yeah. Did you do that while she was tied? Yes. Was it against her will? Her hands were tied, but her feet weren't. Was it against her will, or was it something you talked her into? How did that go? It started off against her will, and then like she wasn't resisting or anything, so I just kept doing it. Did she reciprocate to you? No. After about 5 minutes or so, I let her get dressed again. But before she did that, she had asked if she could take a shower. In the master bedroom shower, which it was. Now, when you said you let her get dressed again, how was it that she came upon being undressed, because originally you said she was dressed? I used a pair of scissors and like cut her shirt off and her skirt off. Was that for the purpose of having sex with her, or another reason that you did that? For the purpose of having sex. Well, let me rephrase that. My purpose wasn't actually sex with her, just oral sex. So you're saying you didn't have intercourse with her? That's correct. But you performed oral sex, is that what you said? Yeah. So you cut her clothes off for that purpose? Yes. Did you take pictures of her? I did, yes. With what? My camera phone. Okay, so go ahead. So now you let her take a shower in the master bedroom. Did you leave the door open? She still had the pillowcase on her head. All right, so when you had oral sex on her, her face was still covered? Yeah, I ejaculated on her stomach. That's why she wanted to take a shower. You did not force her to do that to you? You did it? I did it on my own. So that's why you allowed her to take a shower? Yeah, well, I asked her if she wanted to take a shower and she was like, yes, please. Did you allow her to take a shower without the pillowcase? And Dreamers, yeah, he laughed again at that question, this asshole, and he says, I recovered my face. All right, so she still had never seen you at this point. That's correct. She went and took a shower. When she was done, she came back into the room and I stepped outside so she could get dressed. So I'm going to end the confession part there, and I'll just tell you right now that what he said about what he did to Michaela is not true. He did have intercourse with her. Later on, his DNA would be found inside her. I'm really sorry. That was hard to get through. Sometimes you just, in order to understand the depths of somebody's evilness and depravity, it's just, to me, this guy deserves for everyone to know exactly what he and his buddy did. So I'm going to go ahead and end part one here. When we pick the story back up for part two, I will continue with the transcript of Joshua Kamerzyzewski's confession. Steve Hayes provided a confession as well. However, I'm having difficulty finding any recordings or transcript of it. I will keep looking though, because I want to hear what he has to say. I'm not completely sure. I might be able to pull some details of his confession from some articles, but we'll get to that when we get to that. We still have more of this guy's confession. So don't forget to get on all of the social medias. Follow this podcast on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. I do have a Snapchat and a TikTok, but you know, I can only do so much and I'm not over on those places very often. Also over on Patreon, if you're interested, I covered another case out of the state of Connecticut since we're doing this series. We discussed the 2004 disappearance of Billy Smolinski out of the town of Waterbury. So that's up on Patreon right now as we speak. And for this week, that is all I've got. I want to thank you so much for listening. Part 2 will be out in maybe about a week and a half or so. I got to start writing that. And as always, dreamers, until next time, sweet dreams. And I love you all.